Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For most of us, the American Shaker religious community is known for just a few things. Their meeting songs, which have been adapted by classical and folk musicians, their simplistic but superbly crafted furniture, and their somewhat bizarre beliefs in complete abstinence and gender segregation. But really, little else. Today we dig into the Shakers' beliefs, which form the backdrop of a new gifted first novel by Rachel Urquhart, The Visionist, published by Little Brown, is set against the great spiritual awakening in the first part of the 19th century in America. Teenage girls throughout Shaker communities on the East Coast are falling into trance states and speaking in tongues. Shakers believe them to be visionists, speaking directly from God. When 15-year-old Polly Kimball kills her abusive father in a fire, her mother takes her to a nearby Shaker community where she's adopted, the City of Hope. When she has a breakdown over her previous actions, Shakers believe her to be a visionist herself. Urquhart recreates the world of the Shakers, a culture she's done a ton of research on, and she is a former writer and editor at Spy, Vogue, and Allure magazines. Her nonfiction has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, Harper's Bazaar, and Vanity Fair, to name a few. And she joins us to talk about her new novel, The Visionist, here on Studio Tulsa. Rachel Urquhart, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
This book took a long time in the writing, and you've been a very busy writer, writing on deadline an awful lot. But The Visionist tells the story of the Shakers. How did you get interested in the Shakers?
I managed to find two books in a secondhand bookstore that detailed aspects of the sort of Shaker experience, really, that I had never known about. And one of them was this period, this religious revival period that took place from about 1837 up until, you know, around 1850. And while it wasn't the only religious revival that the Shakers went through, it was a very important one. And it featured very prominently this select group of teenage girls who were falling into trance states and speaking in tongues and kind of behaving in a way that even by Shaker standards was considered pretty wild. And so that whole idea of teenage girls, they were sort of exalted. They were given the title of visionist, and they were exalted in the community and given a lot of power. And the idea of these teenage girls, I don't know, sort of really ruling the actions of the Shaker communities in which they appeared was very interesting to me. And then in the course of reading about this period, I just came across a lot of prayers and songs and aspects of Shaker life that sort of made the sect seem much darker to me than I had ever imagined when I didn't know anything about them. So the combination made for a good fiction. So
now this period you're talking about is called the Great Awakening period of America history, where every denomination was receiving this sort of spiritual renaissance where people were going back to religion, and I'm not really sure why they did it in this particular time. Maybe times were tough. The country was expanding rapidly during this time, but nonetheless, all these faiths explored it. And even though the Shakers separated themselves from the rest of the world almost completely, they didn't seem immune to this, did they?
No, and I think that's a really interesting point. I have to say I'm focused so much on the Shakers that I didn't really take the time to consider in a larger context what it meant for them, their revival, to be happening at the same time as the revivals you mentioned. But I agree, it was really interesting what the country went through. And like I said, I focused on the Shakers, but it was a phenomenon that was nationwide, it seems.
Now, you said you found that the Shakers, as you began getting interested in this particular period, you found that they were a lot darker than you expected them. What was that about what they did that struck you that way?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, my idea of the Shakers is very similar to many people's idea of the Shakers, which is that they were this sort of extraordinarily generous, virtuous society that really cared about the quality of goods that they made and were sort of extraordinarily morally upright and took in the poor, and all of these things are true. But it made them sound a little bit sort of holier than thou to me when I didn't know anything else. And I think the sort of slightly darker side that I discovered is just that they were an extraordinarily rigid society. I think they sort of had to be to keep people working in the way that they worked their congregants. And while they gave an enormous amount to people who signed on, they also asked an enormous amount of those people. So while they, you know, they gave them food, they gave them education, they trained them in certain trades, there was a sense of community that many of these people had never experienced before. There was a roof over their head. I mean, really an enormous amount compared to the way many of these people had lived before. But they also asked a lot of them, and namely, you know, they asked them to give up all relations with the opposite sex, and they asked them to confess all of their sins and continue confessing during their time as a Shaker. They demanded that all worldly goods be handed over to the Shakers. Sort of most difficult of all, at least in terms of what our modern values are today, they really they demanded the dissolution of all family ties, which was a real surprise to me. If you joined as a family, you no longer could recognize your spouse as your spouse, and you could not even recognize your children as your children. In fact, you had to sign a legal document giving your children to the Shakers. And that legal document was one that the Shakers took extremely seriously. And although many people left the community and then tried to get their children back, it was difficult to impossible to do. So I found that to be really interesting. And while I began to understand why the Shakers were so strict in this area, I also, you know, like anyone living in our times, was sort of appalled by it as well. So you can have sort of complicated responses to these people who previously had just seemed sort of, you know, all I knew was 'tis a gift to be simple, 'tis a gift to be free, and sort of all those things that we associate with Shakers.
Good furniture and that quirky thing of not having sex.
Exactly. So that was what I knew, and then what I found out just made them so much more interesting. And really, I should add that the other part of my research focused on what things were like outside of these communities. And the Shakers communities really cropped up in largely rural and quite poor areas of the country. And so when you think about the kinds of people who are desperate enough to, you know, really seek this kind of either moral purity or shelter, I mean, people came for all kinds of reasons. And that was really interesting to me, you know, why people joined and who you had to be in order to sign up for the life that you would have as a Shaker. So that was another part of the book.
Very much a part of the book, because you have to remember, and your book rightly reminds us that in this particular time, when we're talking 1820s, 30s, and 40s, women were chattel. Wives were chattel. Children were chattel. They were the property of the man, and you really depended on that man being a good man, a hardworking man, or if he was a hard-drinking man and a worthless guy, your life was ruined. And this is how this story begins, with one of your main characters, Polly Kimball, is a daughter in this family that is utterly, horribly abused, abusive father, and she leaves that homestead with her mother and her brother in a veil of secrecy, and comes to this, and I would assume a lot of people came to the Shakers in that sort of situation, running away from abusive relationships or abuse either by parents or by spouses.
Absolutely, they did. I mean, I think that the Shakers not only gave shelter to women who were coming from, as you said, all kinds of horrible domestic situations, there were also many poor people who could no longer keep up their family farms. I mean, you were really eking out an existence, a very, very tiny kind of impoverished existence on these small farms, especially the ones in some of the areas that were harder to farm, like, you know, the sort of highlands of Massachusetts and New Hampshire. And when you got to the Shakers, you were given things that you just had never, you know, you were given clothes, you were given food, I mean, things that were not a given in your life, let's just put it that way. So not only were you, if you were a woman, sheltered and safe, but if you were a family, you were looked after. and those things meant, well, they mean a lot now, but they meant a lot then too, because there really were very few alternatives for poor people at that time.
Well, how did this story start to come together? You have this family that seeks refuge with the Shakers at the time of this religious fervor with these visionists. And in the case of this story, you're focusing on a community that they're hearing about other Shaker communities having these visionists, but they don't.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, the phenomenon of the visionists began in the community that's just outside of Albany, in Waterville, New York. And word of what happened there with these girls, which I give a fictionalized version of one of the early visionist events, which was a sort of schoolroom full of girls that really just the afternoon turned into an afternoon of sort of, I don't know, tempered insanity, really, with these girls falling into trance states and, you know, lying on the floor and, you know, twitching and all kinds of things. And I think that once it was decided amongst the Shaker elders that these girls were actually kind of doing, you know, they were able to speak to divine spirits and really deliver messages to the Shakers that would help the Shakers, it became common in other communities to really look for visionists and to want to have a visionist in their midst. And so you're right, the City of Hope, which is my fictional community, has not found a visionist yet. And when Polly Kimball arrives and has a kind of post-traumatic stress, you would probably call it today, reaction to this whole new life, her hallucination is interpreted as one that's similar to the ones that the visionist displayed. And so she is, you know, taken as being a visionist. And I always stay away from the word mistaken because I get the question a lot, you know, do you believe it, that Polly was actually a visionist and just didn't know it? And I found that in the writing of this book, I never decided for myself whether I believed in the visionists or not. I know that some of them were not the real thing, but you know, I also sort of allowed for the possibility that there are people in society who have powers of communication that we just can't explain. And so I tried to leave that open a little bit in the book.
When you wrote that first section of the schoolroom erupting into these trance-like states and you know, speaking in tongues, my first thoughts were of the accounts of what happened in Salem during the witch trials. And, you know, it began with these girls saying they were bewitched by others. And,
absolutely.
You know, and of course they were using it absolutely for power. Now, in this case, were they using it for power or, you know, or was it genuine or were they using it to achieve power? Because the communities, as Polly finds after she has this episode, her status has changed immediately. And she is among some members of the order. You know, they're saying, tell us what, you know, she's been there a day.
Yeah, exactly. Tell us what to do.
Exactly.
Right. No, you know, I thought very much about Salem as well when I started to read about visionists. And I actually looked into other examples where sort of in very isolated communities, teenage girls experienced similarly odd behaviors, sort of, I wouldn't say en masse, but a very, you know, it was a sort of group of teenage girls who really experienced something that I think is in our modern times referred to as kind of contagious hysteria. And, you know, I was fascinated by that. And I think that originally what I decided for myself was that originally it might have been possible that these girls did go into ecstatic states that at least allowed them to sort of feel that they were channeling some kind of message to the Shaker communities. You're right, as the revival kind of went on, you know, teenage girls understand manipulation better than most people. And I think there were a number of girls in the communities who thought, hey, you know, I can actually get some things done if I just behave weirdly in meeting. And so I think that the phenomenon became slightly corrupted as time went on. And I touch upon that in the book because it actually happened. And I don't think the Shaker elders were really prepared in a way for the behavior that came out of this original blossoming. And they had to actually just sort of end the revival at a certain point because they realized it was getting a little bit out of hand, and they just kind of decided that there were no more visionists and nobody really could talk to the, you know, that the divine spirits were closed for business, and, you know, that was the end. So it was kind of interesting to me that the sort of trajectory of these girls who really at first seem kind of like what the Shakers thought they were. They seem to be holy vessels, and then by the end they really are a group of manipulating girls who have a lot of power in the community and really sort of take things to a, you know, kind of extreme place.
My guest today is Rachel Urquhart. Her new novel, her first novel, is titled The Visionist. And Rachel has been a former writer and editor at Spy, Vogue, and Allure magazines, and her nonfiction has appeared in The New Yorker, New York Times, and many other publications as well. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you tell the story in three voices, that of Polly Kimball. This is the girl that has left her family farm and really the death of her abusive father and a fire on the farmhouse. And she, her mother brings the two kids to the Shaker community where she literally indentures them to the community. I found that really interesting. Is like you basically sign away the rights to your children when you bring them in there. And, of course, the two children are separated. They are no longer brother and sister. In fact, her sisters are her sisters, the fellow females of the community. And when Polly has this episode, you have this other character, Elder Sister Agnes, and she's saying, this could be heavenly, this could be devil.
Exactly. Well, I think Elder Sister Agnes has really sort of, she was present at the initial kind of event, the one that's described in the prologue in my book, as a young school teacher. And so when this starts to happen in her own community and happens through this very new, you know, newly dropped off sort of poor, damaged girl, she is somewhat skeptical. And I think what I was trying to do with that character was show that some of these Shaker elders really just felt such responsibility for the health of the community. And what Elder Sister Agnes is really trying to do throughout the whole book is not simply undermine Polly, but to just make sure that, you know, the increasing faith in Polly and the increasing attention that Polly is getting is not going to, you know, kind of end up crashing and burning and really sort of putting the community at risk, you know, of having felt totally disillusioned. So so she's a kind of important watchdog for the community, I think.
Now, the other two characters you tell the story through is Sister Charity, who was Elder Sister Agnes's sort of protege in many cases. She came to the community incredibly young, so this is the only community she's ever known. She's totally involved in the Shaker community, learning how to heal with herbs. And then all of a sudden, she has this skin rash that breaks out all over her body. And all of a sudden, the community, many parts of the community, shun her. And she's lost this sort of position, and yet she remains very idealistic. She's thinking, you know, what have I done to deserve this? But I better redouble my efforts when Polly comes into her life. This is a very interesting character. I really enjoyed reading her version of the story.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I love Sister Charity too, I have to say, in writing her. And, you know, the skin condition, which is an actual skin condition known as figurit erythema, and I may be completely mispronouncing it since it's Latin, and I can't remember my Latin pronunciation very well. But anyway, it's a condition that can arise from stress. And so, and the fact that in her case, as in certain cases of this disease, the lesions are sort of almost beautiful. I mean, they're shaped, they're sort of paisley shaped. I got that idea because for some reason I came across a nursing magazine, and on the back page was a photograph taken in the 1890s by a man who documented many dermatological conditions. And it was the most beautiful photograph of the torso of a young woman covered in these paisley-shaped, this sort of paisley-shaped skin rash, really. And I immediately thought of Charity because I immediately thought that this needs to be a character who feels somehow that in spite of all of the faith that she has given over, and really she's given her entire being to this community, I needed something that made her feel as though somehow she'd done something wrong and somehow she was compromised. And because I needed her to, when Polly comes into the community, really need Polly, because that's really one of the ways she feels that she will become pure again, is if she helps this visionist navigate the community and sort of takes care of her. And it's in the course of taking care of Polly and in instructing her in sort of the Shaker ways that she and Polly become great friends, and the friendship matters as much to Polly as it does to Sister Charity.
And I found it was interesting because you give us an insight into the mindset of a Shaker, too, which I think is really important in knowing this unusual, in many cases, you're right, absolutely right, dark, but absolutely committed lifestyle.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I really lived these characters for the entire time that I wrote the book, and in a funny way, it was actually kind of exhausting because I sort of just had to be them when I was writing them. And I think because the book is voiced, you know, it's told very much, you know, from three different points of view, you know, for me, the only way to do that is just sort of almost the way an actor studies a character, just sort of study them and as I said before, become them. And so I hope that both through my research and through my kind of just really trying to see the world through their eyes, that I give, you know, a somewhat accurate sense of what it might have been like to be a 15-year-old girl in this, you know, circumstance.
Yeah. Well, the third character you tell the story through is this Simon Pryor. Now, the family farm, the Kimball farm, at one point had been a desirable property, but under Polly's father's care, he was a drunkard. He let things go. Basically, there was money there that he squandered it. And so the property has value. And so Simon is working on the behalf of a Massachusetts land baron, I suppose.
Yes, a sort of land speculator
and and he's an investigator. He pretty much roots it out. He says somebody burned the farm, committed arson, killed the husband. He tried to get away on fire, literally running out of the house and then trying to make it to water, but did not make it. But he rules it all accidental because that's the wishes of his employer. And at that point, he sort of becomes fascinated and sort of, I guess, what would you say? He just can't get away from he becomes attached to this fate of this family.
Yeah, his story was difficult for me to figure out. You know, he's initially interested in tracking down Polly and her mother May and eventually her brother, who's too young in the end for him to actually worry about because he would never say anything. But he's initially interested in tracking these, you know, the remaining Kimballs down because he wants to make sure that they do not sort of break down and say that they burned down the house on purpose. And so he wants to make sure that they know that it's been reported as an accident. And so initially it's a kind of covering his tracks thing. But as he begins to understand the circumstances and sort of sympathize with the circumstances that led to this fire, he starts to relate to them as people who, if he can save them, will sort of somehow redeem certain aspects of his past. And so he gets sort of pulled in emotionally to their fate. And that was sort of the inner workings of his story.
One of the things I really thought was interesting is learning sort of the mindset of the Shakers in the beautiful creations that, you know, Shaker furniture is highly desired today. And we think of it as a sense of design, which would probably upset Shakers themselves. Because creating functional, utilitarian, but beautifully made. But this goes into this whole mindset of their creations. It was about glorifying their God by creating the very best things they could, but very simple and absolutely plain.
Well, you're right. And, you know, one of the most well-known Shaker kind of mottos or sayings, and I'm going to misquote it slightly, but the basic gist of it is that you should do everything that you do as if it were to last 1,000 years and you were to die tomorrow. So that is really the spirit that went into everything that the Shakers did. And because of that, the goods that they sold in the world, because that was one of the main ways that they interacted with the world outside their walls. Otherwise, they were extremely isolated communities. But, you know, they were just known worldwide for the quality of their medicinal herbs, their seeds, their furniture, their clothing. Their furniture was actually considered for a long time pretty ugly. I mean, you can imagine in the Victorian era, a Shaker chair that's, you know, extraordinarily functional and very simple didn't hold much appeal. It's really only in more contemporary times that we appreciate the sort of incredibly clean lines of Shaker furniture and the functionality of it. From the Shaker's point of view, it was purely about function and the way the thing worked. You know, it needed to work well, and it needed to be, you know, not showy, and really was about function. So it's a kind of interesting thing that's happened with the way we appreciate the Shakers and the way they, in fact, thought about what they did.
Well, it sounds like it's been an amazing journey on this this novel, and it's, of course, it's getting a great reception now. What's next for you?
Well, it's a good question. I'm about to sort of dive into really mapping out my next novel, which I think is going to be a contemporary novel. I'm not going to write anything more about the Shakers. So that will be a real switch for me. And I also have to say that, you know, as a novelist, I've been incredibly fortunate to have such a rich subject to lean on. It's a little scary to, you know, go out there without that kind of material to work on. You know, I never thought I would write a period novel, but the experience gave me so much to work with that it remains to be seen how I'll do, you know, when I don't have those riches to plunder.
Rachel Urquhart, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Former magazine writer and editor at Spy, Vogue, and Allure magazines, Rachel Urquhart, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her first novel is titled The Visionist. It's published by Little Brown. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you miss one of our recent programs, they're available to hear online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Or you can search through our archives as well as hear older episodes. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.